This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW, because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour, the boots that turn grocery aisles into runways, and all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between, because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Hey, we're back. Hour number two. Doug Santeri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We're here to 10 o'clock. We're off next week for Mardi Gras. We'll be doing other things and unavailable. So we'll be back in 2 weeks. And you know what, Colin? I saw the text come over, and why don't you read that text we talked about at the break?
The last one?
Yeah.
Someone texted in, guys. Good morning. What are your thoughts on the Yankees allowing facial hair on their players?
Okay. Now, the reason I wanted you to read that text is, first of all, that was a George Steinbrenner rule, and I'm surprised it lasted as long as it did. But for me...
When was it first put in place, though? Do you know?
I think it's... back in the days of...
Like, as long as the org's been alive, it's been a
thing. Well, I know it was in place for the George Steinbrenner era.
When was that?
Now,
then?
I don't recall ever seeing Mickey Mantle, Yogi Berra, Babe Ruth, Lou Gehrig with beards. So, interestingly, when I was a basketball referee in Baton Rouge in the 80s, we were not allowed to have beards, I was like, it wasn't a big deal to me. I couldn't grow one. I still can't grow one. But it was sort of an interesting thing. But my response is, I'm surprised it lasted that long, but I'm a Boston Red Sox fan, so it doesn't really matter to me. But I will say this. I want to use that as a segue. And I thought it was an interesting story. My uncle, Johnny Sirt, he was one of the founding members of the, I think it's called, Laporte, it was Laporte Sirt, but I think they shorten it now. It's just Laporte, maybe. And it's a firm in New Orleans. And he always told me the story that he pinched hit for Ted Williams when he was with the Red Sox organization. And I always thought about, could you see your manager looking down the bench and saying, hey, go in there and pinch hit for Ted Williams. Get that bum out of here, you know? So that was always an amazing story. Now the context of it was an exhibition game, and he played double. I think he played in what was double A, was triple A. Now it's in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I think it was, if I'm not mistaken. And it was back right after World War II. So could you imagine walking up to Ted Williams and saying, "I'm your pinch hitter"? So if you're a baseball fan, there's a
right.
A lot of irony to that. But I don't really care. he was a no-hit second baseman who was a great defensive player, as you could say. But anytime I see the Yankees and Red Sox, I always think about that. And God bless him. He died, about 30 years ago, and he was the old timers at Metairie Country Club remember him. So Albert, you were I'm giving you a break a little bit for the first hour. I was doing a lot of talking because I know you have you're struggling with your voice.
Yeah.
But tell us, you had some insight on LSU NIL and basketball, and we want to talk a little bit about that.
So there are going to be some very big, significant changes in the NCAA with NIL. The plan is, and it's all going to depend on a particular court case or two, but it seems like it's likely to happen that there's going to be somewhat of a salary cap. And so there will be a salary cap. It's going to be monitored by each of the, like the SEC, the ACC. Each one of them will monitor all of the schools' salary caps. And if you go over it, you're going to lose, I think, 75% of your cap for the next year. So it's a substantial penalty for going over the cap. But basically, they're going to control it. Right now, you have some unknown booster that, is donating a bunch of money. And what they're going to do is they're going to have a CPA firm kind of monitor everything, at least LSU is. Have them monitor everything and do kind of a cost analysis on certain players and certain positions and have, almost like a court would have precedent for different values. And so they talked about the whole, collective bargaining and all that sort of thing. But basically, it's going to kind of restrict the amount of money being paid to these athletes, and it's still going to be substantial, but it's not going to be just the Wild Wild West.
Okay, a couple of questions. What is the cap based on? Is it based on the revenue of each team, or is it based on the revenue that's going to be set by the SEC? That would be question number one.
Yes. So from what I understand, the revenues are going to be based on the revenues from the particular university. So, the rich will eat the poor. So if they're bringing in more revenues, more TV, selling more this or that, it's not going to be, like the NFL where it's flat across the board.
Right.
Let's say it's for the sake of argument, let's say it's $100 million at LSU, then that money is going to be spread out and they're going to be able to pay it. Now, the other thing he told me, and this kind of relates to basketball, he said that LSU's intention is to spend about over 70% of that revenue on football.
Yeah.
The rest of it is going to be shared with Title IX. The female sports are going to have to get a substantial portion of the remainder, and they're going to kind of look at that in terms of revenues as well, because football obviously brings in the lion's share of the money. And so that, but at the end of the day, it's basketball, men's basketball, just doesn't bring in a lot of money, and the fact that they're not going to dedicate a lot of money to it. They said that he said that in terms of NIL money this year, LSU is dead last in the SEC in terms of how much money they have contributed to basketball. And my response is that's stupid. You need seven guys to have a basketball team, right? You need 50 on a football team plus. Right. And all the coaches, all the money, all the everything. So why not take a good chunk, build a basketball program, and listen, the record almost equates to what they're spending because they're, I think they're last or second to last in the SEC.
Yeah, second to last.
And it's, Yeah, so it correlates almost exactly with the amount of money they're spending. So they're never going to get the five-star athletes. They're not going to be able to recruit. You know, the coach is going to be, and look, what do you want me to do? You know, I'm not the reason we're not getting players.
It's very interesting on a lot of different levels, because if you contrast that with the NFL, as you said, with the flat cap, what had happened was the whole basis of the NFL and its success is competitive. In other words, it's as strongest as its weakest team. And they wanted to have, they wanted to make the NFL competitive in a way that violated antitrust laws. And this sort of gets sorted in the weeds. But basically, the NFL is an antitrust violation. Now, meaning that there's a draft which tells you where you have to work for, for 4 years. You have basically price fixing on salaries. You have a limitation on the amount of compensation. Now, the reason it is not antitrust is because the NFL has a union that collectively bargains these terms and conditions into its agreement. So if they agree to it, they can agree to an antitrust violation, basically.
Right.
If they now, what the NFL understood and Pete Rozelle understood back in the 1960s, that if you don't have a competitive NFL, then you're going to lose. You're going to have a. It's not going to be as strong, because every year there's 30 teams out of 32 that think they have a chance to go to the Super Bowl, aside from Atlanta. So Atlanta and the Jets, maybe. No, I'm just kidding. So that's part of it. When you come to week 16 of the season, you still have 20, 22 teams who have a playoff spot.
Right.
I think Major League.
Oh, no, Pete Rozelle had it figured out. There's no question about it.
In Major League.
Here's my question about that, Doug, about the whole antitrust thing. You go to my university, right? I make all kinds of rules about what you can and can't do at my university. My university has agreed with the NCAA that we're going to be part of this, let's say, football program. So as an athlete, you don't have to play. You don't have to play football. We're not forcing you to do that. But if you want to play, you got to play by these rules. And so we're going to compensate you accordingly. You know, you got to play by the rules of the game. You got to play by all these rules that the coaches set forth in terms of meetings. And so there are a lot of things that people have to do to be able to play in this league. And so why can't they set rules about, same thing with the portal, right? Well, if you come from another school, you got to sit out a year. That's the NCAA rule. If you don't like it, stay where you are. I think why wouldn't the same thing be true as a player to be paid as a player? Now, we've got employment laws that we're dealing with.
Right. I think that's the thing. You hit it right there. In some states, there's a push to make college athletes an employee. And if that's the case, you're going to have antitrust. Because what you're going to have is an artificial suppression of payment of wages. And basically, that could be antitrust. And so the vulnerability of that system would be whether some kind of lawsuit on behalf of one of the players saying the salary cap in college is an antitrust violation. And that's what. And the only way you can beat that is to pass legislation. You know, whether it's probably going to have to be legislation, federal legislation, saying we're going to exempt it from the. We're going to have an exemption, which I'm sure. I know they have had Nick Saban and some heavyweights lobbying Congress right now to sort of do this, because Nick Saban could see this is going to go. It's not the direction is going to in the long term is going to be bad. And so you see, when we went to Minnesota for the appellate court 30 years ago, when we were involved with the NFL collective bargaining agreement, the same lawsuit with Bobby Hebert. The judges sort of said this. It's antitrust but it's athletics. And it does. So if you apply the antitrust laws to athletics, it's going to kill athletics. It's going to kill the competitive balance. That's what he said, basically. So we have to wrestle with this. And that's the same thing you're dealing with right now. If you apply the antitrust laws to college athletics, it's going to ultimately kill it. So how do you maintain a competitive advantage and have it in a way that is not antitrust? And that's the two things. Those are the two considerations that are at odds right now. And I agree. I think a salary cap would be better for everyone because it maintains that competitive advantage.
Right.
The bad part about that is, you know, some clever lawyer is going to go, you know, undo it and say, and if you undo it, college athletics will be far different than anything that we knew, and it's, you know, it won't be as, it'll just be different. It won't be like it is before.
And listen, I'm a fan of NIL, yeah. Right? I mean, some of these kids have to work. They can't support themselves to go, you know, have any kind of recreational. They're either spending time in class or not, but are they spending time in class theoretically? And they're spending a lot of time in practice, watching game films, weight training, doing all these things. And so they don't have the opportunity to make any money, and they're bringing millions and millions and millions of dollars to each of these universities. So I'm all for paying these guys. Now, that the whole portal thing, that's a problem, you know, because as a coach, as a coaching staff, as a university, like Nick Saban said, I can recruit a great player. I just can't recruit him every year. And so, you know, that the good side of the portal is that Alabama doesn't have 5-star recruits on its kickoff team.
Right, like they
did
before.
So the depth that they used to have is now spread out among the rest of the country because, you know, there's no reason for me to sit here and wait 2 or 3 years to show what I can do. Well, let me go now.
What I think they can do is negotiate contracts if they have a cap and it passes all the antitrust scrutiny to say, this is a 2 or 3 year contract. You can't leave.
Right.
But on the other hand, you get paid for those 2 or 3 years, whether you play or not. It's basically guaranteed money. So that would be, you would have a little more equality with that. But I'm really happy about, well, I think it's going to evolve into something that both sides can work with. Hopefully, I blame the NCAA, and I blame them because they were greedy. One of the plaintiffs in the NCAA case that had sued for the NIL rights, he was a student, and he went to Europe. For a summer, I think he was an architecture or something. And he needed a laptop with some kind of AutoCAD like program to it. And so the university asked the NCAA, can we buy this laptop for him for this course? And they said, no, he's an athlete. And so they were so overbearing and so greedy and so not looking to the future that, you know, they blew it. They absolutely blew it, and it just busted all wide open. If they would have got out ahead of it and sort of started transitioning, you know, revenue sharing, all that, it wouldn't have been an issue. They could have managed this. So it's all the NCAA's fault. Now that it's all blown open, the player side has to realize that if we do not have some type of competitive balance, we're going to blow it for ourselves. Well, not for them, maybe in 4 years, but for the future. So you're going to have to get that where the players get paid and you have competitive balance. And if you have that, that can work. I just remember Dale Brown telling us 40 years ago when I was at LSU, there's going to be a day where these players are going to realize that all the money is being made off their backs and they're not receiving a share of it. They're going to go on strike. And they're going to refuse to play. Now, that happened through, I mean, it didn't happen that way. It went through the court system. But he was prophetic 40 years ago in predicting this day would happen. So I think it'll be interesting. And I think, Albert, you raised some interesting scenarios that could possibly save college sports and also maintain its competitive balance so that, you know, it still becomes the, you know, such a big part of our culture and big part of our life and, you know, something that is a good thing in our society. So let's go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back.
Street Easy knows former New Yorkers never stop talking about how much they miss living in NYC.
Life used to feel like a movie, but since we left and bought a house, it's like living in a DIY home repair video.
When it's time to buy, let Street Easy connect you with the right agent you need to never leave NYC. Go to StreetEasy.com to learn more. Street Easy is an assumed name of Zillow Inc., which has licenses in all 50 states.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it. That's why I go for a five-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or whenever my favorite team is playing late. Five-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before tip-off.
Ugh, your clothes are too tight, yet you can't lose weight, even though you've tried so many diets. The reason you're having trouble losing weight could be a liver clogged with fat, and that is slowing your metabolism. Introducing Omicid, a natural superfood protein shake that uses natural amino acids and bioactive peptides to help unclog your liver and optimize your metabolism so it's easier to lose weight, and it's been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. Find out more and see the university studies at omicid.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
Do you believe you were wrongfully terminated for speaking up against your employer? Wilshire Law Firm isn't afraid to go up against corporate giants and will protect you every step of the way. Get justice and feel safe. Call the experts at Wilshire Law Firm at 1-800-800-3333.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new Unrivaled League, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow the Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
After this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. A couple of things we want to clean up before Scotty Craig texts me. A couple of things. He said, first of all, there were not beards in the 70s in Major League Baseball because we had the text about beards in the New York Yankees. And he also wanted me to mention Tom Fitzmaurice's had a great funeral for him. And so God bless Tom and his family. You know, New Orleans is like the Super Bowl of food. And so Tom was, you know, he was the one who told us about, you know, food. You know, food New Orleans. This, you know, it's best in the world. And Tom was on sort of on top of it. Even though I have to admit, I think his show used to follow us every once in a while. And so when we'd hand off the microphone to him, I'd needle him, and I'd always ask him, Tom, what's the best buffet in New Orleans? And he really got irritated with me when I'd ask him that. So there's no buffets in heaven for Tom. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Kent from Gretna. He's got some questions regarding lifetime habitations of his mother-in-law suite in a house. So what you have for us, Kent?
Good morning.
Good morning.
When we purchased the home from my brother-in-law, he retained lifetime habitation rights to a mother-in-law suite attached to the house. We would like the option of selling the home in the near future and wondering how we could negotiate him dropping that particular requirement in the contract.
Okay. Aside from using Albert's Vito Corleone voice, Albert, all right. Is the lifetime habitation filed with the court? I mean, with the clerk of the court?
Yes. Yeah, it's filed with the clerk.
Well, I would believe that the lifetime habitation goes with the property even if you sold it, per se. So you're going to have an amicable Right. Unless unless there's
a provision. So right of a right of habitation, it can't be sold, it can't be encumbered, it can't be transferred, it's not heritable to that person's children. So you're going to have to do something to negotiate, that right of habitation. And it only, unless it's stipulated as less than that person's lifetime, then it terminates upon that person's death. So it, basically set in place. So essentially that person receiving it will have the right to live in that home, or, the mother-in-law suite, whatever, for the rest of their life.
Would it be legal to offer a numerical settlement to maybe...
Would it be legal to what?
To buy it out, you're talking about?
Yes.
If the other side accepts it, it's a negotiated deal. So she has that right. That's lifetime, so you can always negotiate a deal to buy it out. Absolutely.
Okay.
But it has to be voluntary. It has to be a two-party agreement.
How is habitation different from usufruct?
It's habitation.
A usufruct.
Yeah, Albert.
Yeah, a usufruct is different. Habitation just gives you the right to live somewhere. A usufruct gives you the right to the civil fruits, right? It's a combination of two Latin terms, usus and fructus, and it means you got the right to the use and the civil fruits. So if you have usufruct over some rental property, you get the right to receive the rents. You get the civil fruits from whatever the property is. So if they're crops, if they're trees, if they're whatever, those are the civil fruits. So the difference is a usufruct, and there's some usufructs terminate, depending on the contract. Others terminate on remarriage, for instance, a spousal usufruct, unless it's confirmed in a will that the usufruct is for life. So there are a number of significant differences.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks so much. All right. Albert, all right.
You're going to have to buy that out.
You'll buy it out. That's right. Albert.
Find some other place for that person to live and say, how about this? We'll set you up here and you'll have a right. We'll use some of this money to buy a condo for you and live in this condo the rest of your life.
There you go. And if you have the condo, have it so that it comes back to you when you're finished with it.
Correct.
Very impressed with your Latin there. You learned that at St. Paul? Or was that at Loyola?
No, I learned that at Loyola Law School.
Did you? My education at LSAT was wonderful. Loved it. Great education. But I do have one little small bone to pick with my LSAT education was when I went to LSAT in eighth grade, I was going to take Spanish. And my parents talked me into taking Latin for the first year, which is... Why would you want to take Latin when you get by with Spanish? And then when I took Latin, I had a teacher who just immigrated from China with very limited command of the English language. So when I was in eighth grade at De La Salle, I was being taught in Latin by he was a diplomat who just immigrated from China, who had limited command of the English language, and it didn't work out very well. So therefore,
probably not.
My understanding of Latin is very, very limited. And so for all you academics out there, you might want to use a different choice of teacher for Latin in the future. So it's just a little unsolicited advice.
Real quickly, too, if the caller is still listening.
Yes.
He may or may not know this. So if, let's say there's a mother-in-law house behind the house. You see them in little neighborhoods all the time. You got a little rental in the back. They converted a garage or whatever the case may be. But if they have that right of habitation, there is also a corresponding liability for repairs to that part of the property and for, you know, other expenses like taxes and insurance in proportion to the size of that, I guess. You know, if it's 1,000 square feet and the house is 3,000 square feet, you'd end up paying a quarter of those. So, you know, make sure that the person with this right of habitation is paying his or her fair share, because that may be a way to get them out. Say, hey, look, you know, you owe X, Y, Z for the last however many years, and we need you to come up with a payment plan to start paying it. And then you can go to the court and say, look, they're supposed to pay this, you know, and if they don't pay it, we can maybe move to have that right of habitation terminated, you know, from a legal standpoint.
So a little red meat for the negotiation, right?
Exactly.
All right, let's go to the break. Doug Sinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Back. Real quick, got a couple of texts. We got a text from obviously an educator who said, I should have taken Spanish my eighth grade year. I agree with you. Number two, we had another text that indicates that there's only buffets in hell as far as Tom Fitzmaurice is concerned. So there you go.
Right. That's funny.
All right. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to God's country in Covington. Mike's got a couple of questions for us. What you have for us, Mike?
Okay. One is, I don't know, it's about a BP claim I had. Now, I know it's years ago. Mm-hmm. But what had happened, it was originally the Gulf Coast, and my claim was accepted. I received a partial payment. And then Deepwater Horizon came in, and I applied for additional payments, and they denied my claim. You know, it's a while back.
Yeah, I think what they were doing, they were paying some initial payments. We had that before, that they paid an initial payment. They said if you wanted additional payment, you had to prove up your case. And, you know, some were denied, some were accepted. I think it was $25,000 right. You probably got, right?
Well, the other half of it, a lot of times with those initial claims, you signed a release. And so here, we're going to pay you something. Here's your release. And then the format for the reimbursement changed. So all of the plaintiff's lawyers got together, and the plaintiff's steering committee and the defense lawyers, and they got together and came up with this formula for payment. And so, you know, you might have qualified the first time around if you didn't sign a release. Right. But then the second time around, the
new criteria
protocol for payment, the qualifications for payment changed, and then you didn't get it.
Yeah, they sent me paperwork that determined my loss, so that doesn't matter to me, even though it was more than the amount I got.
Well, it's hard to. It's
right,
almost 11
it's
years
a long
after
time
the fact.
Ago. I was just telling something in the paper about BP.
Well, I did.
The
thing is
because
this.
It comes up.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, I was just going to say the criteria changed in the middle of the process. So, like Albert said, you might have qualified for a certain payment in the beginning. Qualification was renegotiated, and maybe the later criteria didn't apply. But
okay. Well, my other question, okay, at the time where it was this property I was working on, I was like, you know, the groundskeeper for a lady for like 16 years, but she died a year ago, and she told me I was going to be in her will. And I saw it the other day, you know, it's in the paper that kids are selling the property. So how can I find out if I was in her will?
Go to the courthouse has it.
Yeah, well, what parish did she die in?
Orleans.
Yeah, so you can look it up. You know, if you know someone that has access to the online records in Orleans Parish, or otherwise you can go down to the clerk of court's office and you know, just ask them to type in her name and see if a succession has been opened. Chances are, if they're selling the property, it's not going to sell unless an administrator has been appointed and a succession has been opened. So you'll be able to see it. They will have to file the will. And so you will be able to read a copy of the will and see if, in fact, she left you in the will. If she did, then I would contact the attorney who is the attorney for the executor or administrator and inquire about the status of your legacy.
So, you can. So, the two things: you go to the courthouse, look up the will, or find out who's the administrator. If you know who the administrator is, ask them. If you don't, call the attorney who's probating the will, and they'll tell you. So between those three, you'd be able to know whether you're in it or not. Okay. So anytime that a succession's filed, you have to have the will probated with the court. You have to have the court recognize the will as being true and valid, and it'll be a public record. All right, thanks for the call. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. Cullen, bang up job with the music today.
I appreciate it.
And your sports interludes are good too, or your news interludes, so sports. So, did you get your raise yet?
I'm working on it.
Ah, look, we might pro bono you and like represent you in this negotiation there. Or we can use Albert's voice right now with Diane.
We can make him an offer they can't refuse.
An offer they can't refuse. So that may work.
An offer they can't refuse.
So, all right, we got to get you up and pay there, man, because you're doing a bang up job. We appreciate all you do. I guess all the parades are rained out today, so I guess they'll be rescheduled accordingly. Sunday, today's a good. I think the two Sundays for Mardi Gras are really like great days because you usually have four or five parades, but not this Sunday. So we hope that everybody gets rescheduled. And Albert, you have your St. Patrick's Day parade, I think on March 16th. Have you given consideration whether to open it up to all the listeners of WWL this year?
Every year, right?
Well, yeah, I sort of invite them without you knowing it because you usually take
off.
Yeah, I know. But you know, I just wondered if we could make it official earlier. We could give addresses. We could say where the booze is. We could just tell them where the bathrooms are. Yeah. Just come in and out. Is that something you give consideration to?
Well, I will tell you, though, on a day like today where all the parades are canceled, not much to do, it's going to be rainy. Mm-hmm. Today is purge day. Going through all the closets and attics and, you know, just pulling stuff out that, you know, we want to get rid of. I mean, I've been to a number of houses doing succession work, and I look around and I think to myself, oh, my God, I don't want to leave this for my kids. You know, just get rid of junk, get rid of stuff, you know, quit hoarding and go through attics and you know, the Monopoly game I probably could probably get rid of by now, you know, and all that kind of stuff that's, you know, related to that. So I think I'm going to spend a little time today inside and just going through stuff and making big piles, give it to Bridge House and let them make a few dollars on it. So
can you save the 20-inch black and white TV for me?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. You got that.
There you go.
You got to get up and change the channels, but that's okay.
You have to. You know, that's what I tell our kids. I tell our kids, you know, when I was growing up, we walked uphill to school and we walked uphill back from school, and I said every time we wanted to change channels, we'd have to traverse 14 feet of shag carpet, get up, turn a knob, and then traverse it back to the sofa. And I'm like,
well, the good news was you only had four channels to choose from, so.
Right.
There wasn't a whole lot of search.
Then you hit UFH, which was you know, where you had to move that little UFH thing if you wanted to get some, like
yeah, channel 26
baseball.
And 38. Yeah.
If you wanted to get used to Nashville baseball, Atlanta Hawks basketball with Pete Maravich. All right, so we're gonna see you in 2 weeks in all things legal. Y'all have a wonderful Mardi Gras. I hope there's great weather, and we'll see you then. Be blessed.